All right, you ready?
I'm ready. You ready?
I am.
Are you ready out there?
Everyone, we got B. Dolan in the house with an exclusive interview.
Yeah.
Say what's up to everyone.
Hey, what ups, everyone? It's your boy.
I wanted to start out. I know everyone knows that you have numerous slam titles and that you, you've got a lot of Def Jam poetry in your past, but I'm not even going to start out with that. Okay,
It was an unimportant detour I took at one point in my career that is at the top of my Wikipedia page forever.
It's definitely important, but I mean, if you want to touch on it real quick, I just feel like a lot of your fans already know that side of you really well, but if there's anything you'd like to say about that.
I don't want to go out of my way to trash anybody, but I reached a point where I was no longer creatively fulfilled or interested at all in what was going on at Poetry Slams, so I bounced. I found my way into it as a weird sort of thing. Like, I was just a fan of hip hop, and I wrote poems that rhymed, and I performed them when I was in New York in, I guess, 99 or 2000, and someone just heard me at an open mic and was like, you should go to the New Eurekan Poets Cafe. So I did, and then that's where I kind of got on stage publicly for the first time, and I started winning right away, and the Def Jam shit, and so it just happened that, like, people came to know me as a spoken word poet before they came to know me as a rapper, and then later it was like, oh, what the fuck, he's rapping. But it, the opposite was the key. Like, the spoken word thing was just a shit, maybe 3 to 5 year, like, well, this is interesting, like, let's see what this is, and let's see if I can do this, and let's, like, and it's like a set of tricks to master that I think is useful. But once you master those tricks, you should get the fuck out of a poetry slam. And, like,
yeah,
I mean, fuck a poetry slam. Like, it was like, there's a 3-minute time limit, and you can't wear costumes, and you can't, like, there's all these kind of arbitrary rules that maybe, in the broader scheme of, like, legislating open mics, maybe it is important to let people know, like, you can't be up here for 10 minutes if you suck, But, I just reached a point where all that shit felt really stifling, so
for
I
sure.
just bounced and formulaic.
Gotcha. Now, I understand around that time is when you left college and you just bought a drum machine and you started working on your first album, Failure. Is that correct?
Yeah, because I did the Deaf Poetry Jam thing, and that was, like, my exposure to the industry, and I was just horrified by it. It made no sense to me. I didn't know what the fuck anybody was talking about. People were coming up to me, I'm a manager, I'm a producer, I don't know what any of this shit is. Yeah. Everyone's beautiful, everyone's on cocaine, everyone's like, I'm 18, living out of a fucking knapsack, selling weed, and fucking, like, crashing on friends' couches and shit. And I still had years of experimentation ahead of me. I kind of knew that. And so, instead of trying to let them mold me into the next Eminem, which is what they were mostly interested in at that time. This is like 99, 2000. Instead of that, I was like, I can't rely on anyone else. So I got myself a laptop. Just as that stuff was getting affordable too, it was kind of like the cusp of that shit was when I could walk into a music store or that was like the first time it was like Cubase. And programs like Acid and SoundForge and shit, those were, like, just starting to happen. So that was the Absolutely. Beginning of, like, the whole world figuring out, like, oh, I don't have to, like, pay somebody to go sit, like a professional studio engineer. Because a lot of people aren't ready for that.
So, totally.
So I just became one of the bedroom people for 8 years.
And that's awesome. I wanted to ask you about some of your volunteering for at-risk youth programs. And I also understand that you started did you start the website nomore.org, or are you a co-founder?
Me and Sage.
You and Sage did it together.
I was living in New York on 9/11, and when I came home, I just was very convinced that, like, it wasn't enough to write about politics. I needed to get involved in social justice work. And so, because I didn't know anything at the time other than just art, which was my shit, like, we created this program called Open Mics, where we go into high schools and perform and work with the weirdos, the kids that would attract to that, and kind of bring them out into the scene. And weirdly enough, my sound engineer that I'm on this tour with is someone whose high school I went into.
That's
in, like,
awesome.
2002.
Sweet.
And now he works as a sound engineer in New York City, and I, like, called him up and was like, hey man, I need a sound man. Yeah. So that that was the first project, and then the other No More was the other project, which was we were looking at, you know, like educated consumerism and voting with your dollar and that stuff around 2005. And yeah, there was no resource online where you could enter the name of any brand, product, or company and just see who owns this and like what is their record. So that's what No More became.
That's really awesome. Yeah. I think that's a great thing. And I'm kind of surprised that website didn't exist previously. And it's right. Awesome that you guys...
Well, this is 2005.
Yeah, so I guess it's...
This is like John Kerry had just lost to George Bush.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this is 3 years before the financial collapse. Like, we were talking about corporate personas. I mean, we weren't the first. Like, people like Ralph Nader and Public Citizen existed and have been yelling about this shit since the 60s. But, yeah, you know, it was... And then 3 years later, you know, everyone was talking about Wall Street destroyed the fucking country.
Right.
It all became, like, really apparent. But, and it's still relevant now, you know.
Absolutely. And around 2005, that's when you signed to Strange Famous, right?
2005 was my first tour.
Okay.
I didn't manage to put out an album on Strange Famous till 2008.
Oh, okay.
2005, I went on tour with Sage and just was his merch guy and his driver. And that was, like, the point at which I figured out, like, oh, wow, like, there's an audience for this weirdo shit I make. Like, I really had given up on that. After the encounter with Def Jam and all that shit, I just was like, well, you know, I'm going to make weird political emo shit, but there's no market for that. No one's ever going to pay me to do that. And then Francis took me on a tour. I was like, oh, wait, no, there's hundreds of kids in every city around the world that will pay you to do that if you're good at it, you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I personally think you flow perfectly on that label. Like, you and Francis, I think you guys just are, like, I don't want to say two peas in a pod, but whenever I hear you guys together, I think you just bounce off each other really well.
Yeah, we've become each other like old married couples do. Like, we spent so much time with our thighs pressed against each other in economy class that eventually you just absorb the other person's worldview.
Another question I wanted to touch on is some of your alter egos that you use on stage, like Bombs Away and Evel Knievel.
Yeah.
And I just wanted you to, like, how did you come up with these? What made you start doing alternate characters in your performances?
Partly the slam stuff I mentioned.
Yeah.
Partly that was, like, a reaction at that time to, like, being told I couldn't use props. I was like, I can use props if I fucking want to use props. Like, who the fuck are you?
Right.
You know, like, I started doing this, like, characters that were more fully formed and would act like a weird, absurd occurrence during a rap show or a poetry slam. I wanted to just, like, disrupt the normal, you know, because any situation where the crowd thinks they're going to show up and do a prescribed set of things, and, like, you know, they know what the show's going to be before the show happens, we're going to throw our hands in the air, we're going to say, ho, somebody's going to fucking rap, you know?
Right.
That's a great opportunity to just, like, crash that and just fuck it, like, you know, the needle comes up off the... You know,
totally.
Like, it was that type of moment. Which is how then a whole other group of people came to first hear of me, which made it even more confusing when I started rapping. Because the first time I played Paid Dues, I didn't rap at all. I was in the fucking Evel Knievel costume,
right,
giving a pep talk and then jumping a tricycle over 3 toy buses and off the end of the stage. That's why I met LP after that show. I was, like, walking out the door and LP was walking past me. He was like, did you make it? I was like, I don't know. That was it.
That is awesome.
But yeah. That stuff is well documented on YouTube. Go search for that.
Yeah, definitely. Anybody's listening to the interview, definitely go look that up. So right around 2010, you made your second album, which I actually have a poster for right here, Fallen House, Sunken City.
Yeah.
Then I know that between each album, you seem to spend a decent amount of time working on your music, which I really admire, because some people just want to belt stuff out and get it out there.
Yeah.
But you and all your music is really well written and has a lot of good information, a good message to it. And I was just curious... like, what's your process is for working on each one of these albums? Do you just, like, really spend a lot of time on each song, or do you come up with, like, 50 songs and narrow it down?
I don't do that. I almost have nothing extra when the album's done, which is odd. I'm trying to get better at that and become more of an engine, but because I do think there's a thing of overthinking. But it's in general, up to this point, it's definitely been a process of like, not really not wanting to copy anyone else, really not wanting to copy anything I've already done, and yet wanting to make things that are new difficult to make for me. Because like once I know how to make a thing, then it becomes like I feel like that's how you fall off, when it's just like, yeah, I know how to fucking churn out a Beatolin record these kids will buy. Let's get in there and phone it in, and like, yeah, what do we need? You know, 16 verses, or 16 bar verses rather. So I've tried all along the way to make it hard for myself, and I've definitely fucking succeeded. Last album took 5 years. Yeah,
but I'm sure you do a lot of touring in between. I know you have like a 3-volume mixtape series, the House of Bees mixtape series too. Yeah, so I know you're doing stuff in between for sure.
Yeah, and sometimes it relies on, like, sometimes I'm chasing something that's really elusive, and we have to like just grind it out. Like there's a song on the last album that took 6 months to make. Wow. And we made a whole other version of it, and like tracked grand pianos and shit.
Nice.
Like this really elaborate, really dynamic version of it, and it just wasn't like, I wasn't liking it, and then I took it home and I like stripped everything out of it one day and just like sped up the tempo, you know, by 5 or 10 or something. I just made it move a little faster, and it accomplished what needed to happen for me to like the song again.
Hmm.
And then when I came back to the studio, the engineer was like, "Well, you know now that all that shit we recorded is fucked. Like you can't just turn up the grand piano recording. It's at 90. You know, if it's at 95 BPM, it's gonna sound fucked up now."
Yeah.
So like, I mean, we threw out. My engineer still has fucking shout out to DS3K. He still has, like, sometimes we'll just be sitting in the control room, and I'll play the start of that beat, and he just, like, his body tenses up, like he has like a PTSD reaction. Okay? Yeah, the song is Rats Get Fat. There's an old version of it that didn't work.
That's a great story.
We used that instrumental though in a movie. I scored a movie last year and wrote a movie last year.
That was another thing I wanted to ask you about. Yeah. Yeah, tell me about that a little bit.
That is a really weird thing. It's this writer and director from Rhode Island, Michael Corrente, found out years ago that I could write and asked me to write him some horror movies. And I wrote him like 3 movies over the course of 5 years, and nothing ever came of any of them.
Huh.
Yeah, and we worked for free quite a lot. Like, and while I was writing movies for him for free, this other dude was like running his dry cleaning around and like just interning for free, because he wanted to be in movies. And when nothing ever came of that other stuff, I just kind of like said forget about it. I always just treated it like a exercise anyway, because I don't know shit about the movie industry. I barely know about the music industry at this point, and. So, you know, like, who the hell knows how anything gets made or doesn't it? But then last year, Tom hit me up and was like, "Are you still writing? You know, I remember you. I like the way you write." And Tom, who is the intern now, is a writer and director in his own right, and, like, has another production company.
Is that Verity Productions?
Yeah. And I just wrote them the movie, again, with, like, very little expectation of what the hell was going to happen. And, and they made it into a movie. And
that's awesome.
And, yeah, it's out on Netflix, and it's called Almost Mercy. And yeah, they let me score it too.
I'm definitely checking that out.
And we used the old version of that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's like the very dramatic theme that plays, I think, during the title sequence, and then during like the height of the movie. Because that was the thing. It was too, the music was too dramatic. It was almost like campy or silly or like video gamey or something for the album. But then like when applied to a movie scene, it was like, oh yeah, perfect. Like, because like movie for films is really different in a way that I liked a lot. I actually want to score more movies.
Nice, yeah. From what I actually read, I actually found this on your Wikipedia. It said that you were working on some films for Verity. Oh, did you?
No.
Oh. And it said that you had done the score for one movie, and that there was another film in the works that isn't out yet that you worked on.
Yeah, that's I'm in the notes process for that one with them. Yeah, I wrote them a second movie. And the hope is it's going to be like built up a bit budget-wise and everything from like a step up from Almost Mercy. Because Almost Mercy, they made really cheaply. And, you know, what we were able to do with that, everybody was super impressed and happy. So I was like, well, I'll write you another one. So yeah. Yeah, I'm excited about that.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm definitely going to have to check that out on Netflix. Changing the subject a little bit, I wanted to know a little bit about the Church of Love and Ruin.
Yeah.
And that's, is this, it's like a, is it like a tour that you guys put on that combines art and activism? Or is it just like a show in a certain...
It's not much, there's not much activism involved. I mean, people took it that way because we included queer performers, with hip hop performers, and so people kind of there was that about it that was sort of, I guess, radical and interesting. But yeah, it's the reason people wrote about us. But what it really was me just at the end of a pretty hard year in 2010, wanting to like just kind of re-energize myself and keep myself inspired and interested in live performance. And so I put together this package tour where I reached out to just like all my favorite performers. That was really the only criteria of like who would I like travel to watch if they were within 3 hours of me.
Oh, cool.
And that is my friend. Yeah. So yeah, it included this 19-piece marching band called the What Cheer Brigade from Providence. It included these drag queens from Boston named Katya, whose shirt I'm wearing right now, and who was featured on the last season of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Oh, wow.
And Mr. Cole Pride. A sissy bounce MC from New Orleans named Vaka Radu, whose live show is like one of the most incredible things I've ever seen in my life. Wheelchair Sports Camp from Denver, they played one of them. Grand Buffet from Pittsburgh. It was, you know, it was just really, you know, the people that I really wanted to watch. And yeah, we did it 2 years in a row as a 4-show tour in the Northeast. So we played like Portland, Boston, Maine, and Providence. And then there was interest from England. And so we flew most of us, like 27 people, to England and played like, I think 6 or 7 shows. Slept in like a venue that just gave us a place to be, and fans brought air mattresses and fucking because you can't, I couldn't put 27 people in a hotel, so like we're showering at like a local homeless shelter around the corner that let us use their showers, and yeah, we'd play the show and come back to Britain, and then at the end we played Bestival, and Stevie Wonder was the headliner.
Oh wow.
And by the time we got to Bestival, motherfuckers were just lined up awaiting their credentials, and like the organizers were like coming out of the tent to look at us. They were like, you're like an army. We were in like 2 16 passenger vans and a third van for equipment and more people, and they were like, you brought more people than Stevie Wonder. And we didn't lose money. We didn't lose fucking money. That was like, we didn't make money. That's but we good. Didn't fucking lose anything bringing that many people around Europe, which is still incredible in retrospect.
That's definitely awesome.
But yeah.
Is that something that you guys are still doing, or is that just something that went on for a little bit?
That was once-in-a-lifetime shit.
2011 is around when that happened.
Yeah, yeah. People overuse that once-in-a-lifetime thing, but, like, all that year, I was like, hey, guys, this is some once-in-a-lifetime shit happening. And when it was over, you know, I was just emotionally exhausted, and, you know, people ask about it forever now. Like, when does that happen again? Never, motherfucker. Never. Yeah, bro. I got Stevie Wonder money. Just do it on a bus or something.
So your newest album is Kill the Wolf, right?
Yeah.
And that came out on July 10th last year, right?
Yeah.
And I noticed that was released under Strange Famous and Speech Development.
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked up Speech Development, I saw you were listed as an artist only for the UK in parentheses. So yeah. What is Speech Development exactly?
Speech Development is an imprint of Scroobius Pips, who is on Strange Famous in the U.S., which is why this, I can totally understand if this is confusing. But yeah, he, I mean, he just has the U.K. on lock. He was part of a really successful band called Dan Lesak versus Scroobius Pip, and then he put out his solo stuff, and then he started a podcast that's like the number one podcast in the U.K., and he's acting, and he's, you know, like, he's just killing shit over there. And over here, he has a lot of fans, too. And he's someone that, when he toured here for the first time, when Francis put out his record here, Francis kind of paired us up and had me tour with Pip, and that's how we met, became good friends, and yeah, so when we were just looking at how to put Kill the Wolf out, we were just looking at what resources were available, and Pip was interested in like licensing the album from Strange Famous to give it kind of a very UK specific push. Which he did, and he fucking killed it, man. You know, like, we were playing to packed rooms, you know, 300 That's capacity awesome. Rooms all over the UK in weird towns that nobody can play. Like weird towns that other people, bigger, much bigger acts in my genre, look at my schedule and they're like, what the fuck is this town you're playing? Where, how do you, who's there? I'm like, 200 kids are there, man. Like, because Pip, you know, really like brought me all the way through in England. Like, I've toured really extensively in England. And they loved the shit out there. You know, probably some of my best audiences in England and Ireland.
Sweet. Yeah, I was actually watching some of your music videos and live performances on YouTube, and at the end of one of them, it listed, I think, maybe that tour.
Yeah.
And it had all the dates, and I was really surprised at all those
different...
Yeah,
some cities you never
even heard of. Yeah, I've never heard of a lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do this shit, man. Shout out to England.
Yeah, shout out to England for sure. That pretty much covers all the questions I had for you. I also wanted to ask you about your EP, the Live Evil EP. Is that, I actually haven't gotten the opportunity to check that one out yet. And is that under the Evel Knievel personality, or
that was actually something that came out. That might have been my first Strange Famous release, I guess. This was way back in the day, in 2008, when people bought vinyl records. Actually, people are really buying vinyl records now. But, like, in between now and 2008, there's been a lull. Mm-hmm. And there was definitely, in 2008, that was, like, right at the end of a time when labels would put out a limited edition 12-inch single ahead of an album, which is not so much of a practice. I mean, it used to be a huge tradition in rap where, you know, that was what was so dope, is, like, any hit that ever came out, and even some non-hits that came out, there'd be a 12-inch, which would have the instrumental and the acapella and all that shit.
Definitely.
And so right at the end of that was when I put out my first record, and Strange Famous made this EP to kind of, like, get record stores interested in carrying my stuff for the first time, I think, also. And, yeah, so it features... I'm trying to think what's on that. It features the Sky Cycle Blues. It features... I guess it features mostly material from The Failure. And it also has an instrumental for Heart Failure. And, oh, it's got an outro on Love Will Survive and Crow on the Riddle that, because of the samples they contained, I couldn't put on the album.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's like a weird little collection piece.
Cool, yeah. Is that something that you can order off your website?
I think it might be for sale still.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a few copies left.
I'll have to check that out for sure. Awesome, man. Well, I think that about covers it. I put together a lot of good questions. I feel like I talked to you a long time, but I don't want to take up your sound check and everything.
Well, thank you.
So I really appreciate you doing this.
Thank you guys for covering the show.
For sure.
Playing our shit. Long live the pirates.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Is there any way we can get some drops from you?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
So we have... you could just say, like, this is Beagle and you're listening to...
I'm so bad at these.
I try to keep them as simple as possible.
I'm going to write down... Because what I always fuck up is, like, I try to be funny, and then I'm funny, and then I lose the name of the station. All right, so what am I saying?
So you're going to say, you know, Beagle, and you're listening to Colorado Community Radio Network. Okay. And you're going to do one for Greenlight Radio.
And then one for my radio show, too.
For this show. If that's okay.
Greenlight Radio?
Yeah. If we can get all three, that'd be awesome.
And what's the radio show called?
POL Radio. It'll just be, you're listening to POL Radio, where hip-hop lives.
Okay.
You have your own slogan and everything.
Yeah. The common one, but... do you want me to stop this and do a new recording?
Go ahead and stop it, just to make sure.
No. Your buttons are worn down. I don't want to hit the wrong button.